We must call on governments to step up on cutting their emissions, step up on climate finance, step up on loss and damage. Take it seriously.
Turning up the heat on climate negotiations. Wednesday, November 16th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today, we're diving deep on the United Nations Climate Conference happening in Egypt. That was the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, we heard a moment ago. And a little later, we'll explore that term, loss and damage, she mentioned, which has been a major sticking point for years. But first, a little background. This is the 27th COP, or COP, which stands for Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that's what people are referring to when they say COP. And this year, it's in Sharm el-Sheikh, a Red Sea resort town in Egypt. Global leaders have so far failed to deliver on promises made years ago to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, a target scientists say would likely avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And greenhouse gas emissions are on their way back up after a brief pause during the pandemic. To set the scene and survey what's at stake, producer Hafsa Qureshi convened a roundtable of climate reporters covering the talks from around the world. Vivian Shime, based in Abuja, Nigeria, is a climate change reporter with The Cable, an independent online newspaper. Zoha Siddiqui, in Karachi, Pakistan, is a freelance journalist covering technology, the environment, and human rights. She's also a journalism professor at Habib University. And Giovanna Girardi in Sao Paulo, Brazil. She's a freelance environmental reporter and host of the climate podcast Tempo Kenchi. They spoke to Robin Young last week as the conference was getting underway.
Vivian, I want to start with you there in Egypt. One of the themes and one of the hopes out of this COP 27 was that the countries, particularly countries in Africa, that are not contributing to climate change but are being affected by the contributions of the larger countries, the U.S., China, India, had expected some kind of financial help to pay for the damages they're getting from other countries' emissions. What's the sense there of what's happening?
Of course, COP 27 is said to be the implementation COP, and there's so much talk about it also being Africa's COP, right? But the thing is, there's been like past indices that is giving African delegates doubts that this COP would actually deliver on its implementation mandate. Some of the conversations I had with the delegates at COP 27, some of them are just like, we are not sure we're going to get this money. They keep making pledges, they keep saying these things, but the processes of assessing this financing is difficult for African countries. African countries don't have the expertise to assess climate financing. And every year they come and make pledges, but how much of this money comes to African countries? And despite all of the pledges, Africa is still stuck in that mess of climate change impacts affecting people in the continent.
So, Vivian, you're there in Egypt, but from Nigeria. Zoha, in Pakistan, we know that Pakistan has just suffered terribly from climate change, first drought, flooding. How would you describe the impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Pakistan is among the countries most vulnerable to climate change. This year, as you know, and you just mentioned, we were hit by devastating floods, which the United Nations described as an unprecedented climate catastrophe. Alongside flooding, Pakistan also faces a rate of warming considerably above global average. We saw earlier this summer when extreme heat weakened the flow of water to the Indus River, resulting in a 38% water shortage in Punjab and Sindh, which are major crop-producing provinces, right? So even before the floods hit the country, we were already facing massive food insecurity. And so all of this arrives before the backdrop of an economic crisis. And this, of course, threatens to complicate the task of responding to unfolding disasters, rebuilding and rehabilitation.
Well, here's what your prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif, says about, you know, what the expectation was. I mean, he says the estimated damage has exceeded $30 billion. And here's what he said during his national statement on Tuesday.
Despite our very low carbon footprints, we became a victim of something with which we had nothing to do. This is simply unjust and unfair, to say the least.
But Zoha, are you feeling the same way that Vivian is from Nigeria? That there were all these promises of aid and the most emitting richer countries helping the countries that are poor and suffering the effects of climate change, that there's a disappointment that that's not going to happen.
100%. You know, in a way that there's disappointment, there's knowing that maybe nothing will come about as a consequence of this call for loss and damage. Having said that, though, I certainly believe that holding the summit outside the Global North allows Global South countries to navigate through Western delaying tactics. I also think the clamor for climate reparations has certainly been louder this year.
Yeah, I mean, just all the different side effects of climate change. And Giovanna, there in Brazil, I want to make sure we get to you because you've been focusing on the deforestation of the Amazon. We've been talking about this. I'm thinking of Sting, you know, decades ago, talking about it. There was a sharp increase under your now former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who lost to Lula da Silva. Do you think that because of that political change, there might be a chance to, you know, save the Amazon?
Well, I really hope so, because as you said, we are seeing this, we have a deforestation problem for many decades now, but with Bolsonaro, we had an increase. For the first 3 years, we had an increase of 73% of deforestation. So yes, we like revert our gains in this area. So Lula, he put Amazon and climate change in the spotlight during his campaign promises. In his victory speech, he promised to reach zero deforestation in the Amazon, to resume a leading role in the fight against climate crisis. And he pledged to resume the surveillance for the entire Amazon to any illegal activities and things like that. So I think the most important role that Brazil can play in the climate change fight is to avoid deforestation, because this is our main source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, but there's so many competing interests. I mean, we know earlier this year, the British journalist Dom Phillips and the Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Pereira were murdered during a reporting trip in the Amazon. We're reminded it's not just the world's largest rainforest and so important, you know, that canopy for the rest of the world, but also a cover for all sorts of illegal activities. And local indigenous people who want to do their work, you know. You have been to the Amazon. I mean, just if you could just take just a few seconds and tell us, you know, more about the peril, the grandeur, the importance. What, you know, what does it feel like?
Yes. Yeah, I went to some parts of Pará State that have a very long history of occupation and deforestation, but also to places that are in the frontier of deforestation, like the region of a city called Novo Progresso, a city where the infamous fire day happened in 2019. And what I most sensed there were these feelings of impunity. And I talked with a mayor of a city called Itaituba, where illegal mining is growing and it's a very unsafe situation there. And he, for example, defended for me in an interview openly, like, okay, mining is good, logging is good, prostitution is good. Nothing of these activities destroy Amazon. No, here is everything okay. So it was a very, very disturbing situation. It was a very disturbing talk, I would say.
Well, I would say that it exemplifies that all of you have a dangerous job. I mean, the fact that environmental reporters are being killed because people don't want the information to get out. Giovanna, you talk about being in the Amazon, which is, you know, can be a dangerous place. And Zoha, there in Pakistan, I'm imagining that you're not always able to get maybe the information that you need from the government. Thoughts there?
Yeah, it's notoriously difficult to get access to the government here, or to get access to government data, often because it does not exist. It's also very difficult to get access to environment agencies, right? So the city that I live in, Karachi is facing the combined impact of sea level rise and land subsidence. There has been unchecked development along Karachi's coastline, and they've been conducted without environment impact assessments. And so I conducted an investigation about this recently, but no comment from the government.
Yeah. Vivian, there in Nigeria, we know you're focusing on flooding in the southern areas there, how it's increasing disease outbreaks. Talk about your challenges there.
Okay, so basically, Nigeria had its worst flood in decades this year. And a lot of things happened across communities, you know, dead bodies being exhumed from the ground and people drowning, you know, submerging houses and people, over 600 persons dead already and 2.5 million affected. Before Nigeria came to COP27 this year, this issue of flooding was on the front burner and a couple of other issues affecting Nigeria, which was great. But one thing we have come to see at COP27 is that Nigeria is being represented just by maybe our ministers. The president of the country is not at COP27. Mm. He's not even in the country right now. It's sad that a lot of things are happening and people are dying and they are not being properly represented at COP27.
Yeah. Well, I admire all three of you for your work and your dedication. Zoha Siddiqui in Karachi, Pakistan. Vivian Shime, she's from Abuja, Nigeria, but she's in Egypt at COP27. We've also been speaking with Giovanna Giraja in Sao Paulo, Brazil. All of them environmental reporters and facing the real challenge of that job and of getting the word out about climate change. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Robin. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
After the break, the nations least responsible for climate change are calling on the biggest emitting countries to pay up. Stick around. There's a lot of jargon in climate negotiations, but one term you might hear a lot is loss and damage. It sounds like something an insurance claims adjuster might say, and in this case, it means poorer countries asking richer ones to pay up for emitting the majority of the greenhouse gases that have driven climate change. Pakistan's prime minister called it necessary to, quote, meet the pressing humanitarian needs of those suffering the brunt of the climate crisis. Salimul Haq is director of the Bangladesh-based International Center for Climate Change and Development. He's at the conference, and he told Peter O'Dowd that loss and damage is different from calls for richer nations to help fund things like renewable energy development around the world.
Absolutely. This is a compensation mechanism for the victims of pollution from the polluters. That's the principle under which we are discussing.
And how might it work in your country of Bangladesh?
Well, in my country, in Bangladesh, we actually provide quite a lot of assistance to the victims of climate change ourselves from our own government. And what we would be looking for is for that to be augmented by additional finance coming from developed countries. They do come now, to be fair, but they come as humanitarian assistance. But what we are asking for, particularly in the COP, in the Framework Convention, is to acknowledge that there is now a causal element. It is the polluter causing the problem, and therefore polluters need to take responsibility and to pay something to the victims of their pollution. It's not just rich countries helping poor countries because they feel bad about it. It's rich countries causing the problem and therefore having to take responsibility to help the victims.
Now the question is how much? So the prime minister mentioned that damage from the floods in Pakistan exceeded $30 billion. That was just in Pakistan, just one country, one flood in a single year. So when you look across the globe, how high is the price tag for loss and damage?
It's certainly in the many tens of billions, possibly even in the hundreds of billions. But that's not something that we are asking for immediately. We are asking for initial payments to be provided quickly. At the moment, we are getting $0. So even $1 is better than zero.
Hmm. So if these payments were to be made to countries like Bangladesh, how would the money be used?
Well, how to use the money would also have to be something subject to negotiation and agreement. But essentially, it would be going to the victims, particularly the poorest victims, who are suffering the impacts of climate change. they happen to be suffering. We take the floods in Pakistan, for example. Millions of people have become homeless. Their houses have been destroyed. They need to be rehabilitated. They need to be helped.
And I understand that some countries, Denmark, for instance, have committed some money for climate reparations, but this is on the agenda officially for the first time at a COP conference. Why has it been so hard to bring countries like the United States and China and the European Union on board?
I think the biggest difficulty has been a perception, and in my view, a wrong perception, that they would be opening themselves up for unlimited claims of liability and compensation, which is not the case. The developing countries, particularly the vulnerable developing countries who are suffering, are not complaining about liability and compensation. They're just asking for solidarity funding to help the victims of climate change from some of the polluters who caused the problem. And at the moment, we're just asking for voluntary contributions. And as I said, Denmark is the only conference of parties party country that has offered 100 million kroners, which is roughly $13 million.
One of the issues with reparations of any kind is often that the people who are being asked to pay them don't feel as if they should be responsible for paying for the crimes of the past. And so, for instance, what would you say to people who say, you know what, it's not the responsibility of the United States to compensate poorer countries?
Well, it's undeniable that the United States has been a big polluter and has made a big contribution to the emissions of greenhouse gases. That's now scientifically established fact. So what we're asking for is to take some responsibility and provide some money in solidarity to the victims. We're not asking for reparations. We're not asking for liability and compensation. We're just saying provide something out of a sense of moral responsibility and a sense of solidarity with the victims of your pollution.
Do you expect a breakthrough at this meeting? And if there isn't, what's at stake? What might happen?
Well, I certainly hope to have a breakthrough. The getting it on the agenda was the first breakthrough. Hopefully, we'll agree to do more. We won't do everything in this COP, but at least we'll agree to take it forward. And maybe next year, by the next COP, we can actually make it happen and have the money flowing by then.
Saleem Al-Haq with the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh. Coming up, reflections from one farm in Western India, and how one family is grappling with an increasingly unpredictable monsoon season. That's after the break. Unusual weather patterns are making it more difficult for farmers in many parts of the world to get by. In Florida, farming losses could be as high as $1.8 billion in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. It's a sadly familiar story on the other side of the world, in India, where Mukta Dharma Purakar recently visited her family's farm. As she reported for YR Media, climate change is messing with the monsoon season and putting farmers' futures in jeopardy.
That was my mom. We're currently standing in front of what used to be a storage shed on my grandfather's farm, except now it's crumbled to pieces. Needless to say, a lot has changed since I last visited my grandparents in Maharashtra, India, in 2019. Two floods and countless droughts later, everything looks different from what I remember. Buildings that once stood multiple stories tall have been reduced to piles of rubble. Washed up trash lines the waterways and wells, each piece leaving a thick trail of sludge as it slowly passes through on the way to its next destination. But there's also a new tension in the air, which I can see in the worry lines streaking across the workers' faces, the cautious flitter of my grandfather's eyes as we near the river. And worst of all, the perfectly good okra sprawled across the grass, discarded by a discouraged farmer coming back from the market. My grandparents have lived in the same house right at the end of the long alley, with the open roof and the splotchy tiled floors and the squeaky outhouses since my mom was 13 years old. They hadn't changed a thing in over 30 years. But when I came back this year, many things were different. the doors on the outhouses had been replaced because of water damage. Shelves and shelves full of papers and books were completely gone. Everything changed when the floods hit. But what exactly happened here? Here's what a farmer living near my grandfather told me. There was one flood in 2019 and one in 2021. The crops were drowned, and the chickens and other farm animals drowned. The problem isn't necessarily the rain itself. It's the way the rain arrives. The monsoon is changing. When I was much younger, I remember feeling giddy when the rains came pouring down for a few days each week, delivering a reprieve from the heat and the mosquitoes, and a perfect opportunity to get a scolding from my mom after running outside to play in the rain and coming back completely drenched. But recently, the rain has started to look different. I talked to a farmer living in a nearby city. Before, our monsoon was perfect. It would start in June, and there would be scattered rainfall throughout June, July, August, and September. It would fall bit by bit. Now, the rain doesn't fall like that. We'll have the same average rainfall, but all within 1 week or 15 days. It's not as scattered throughout. The monsoon has become more irregular and heavier. Studies have found that for every degree Celsius of warming, Indian monsoon rainfalls will likely increase by about 5%. For young people, this is more than just a physical or economic toll. It's a mental one. It's the stress I feel when I see my parents and grandparents huddled in the corner of a room, poring over monsoon reports, trying to predict what will happen next. When I see the water levels in the well rising higher and higher with every passing day. When my grandfather hands me a 100 rupee note as a parting gift, and my mother hastily presses it back into his hands. But this is nothing compared to what the young people who are actually growing up on these farms are facing. The constantly looming worry, the ever-present stress that makes the future something to brace yourself for rather than something to look forward to. The forced acceptance that nothing is truly in your hands anymore. And the inability to do anything about it. Because of this situation, what are the kids going to do? Why would they keep farming? If this happens every year, then how is it going to be viable? How will they provide for their kids? Nobody wants to do agriculture. Now, I know old folks are always grumbling about how the young people are leaving them behind, escaping the comfort of the culture they were raised in for the enticing glamour of the big city. But this exodus of young people doesn't just weigh down on folks like my grandfather. It harms the entire community. Not only are they losing the backbone of their future economy, but also the caretakers, the teachers, the counselors. Those who are both going to support the elders like my grandfather and raise the next generation. The kids leave and go to other towns, so those towns get development. But the development of our town has stalled. If you go a little further from here, there's been a lot of growth. But our kids haven't been educated. These kids have grown up immersed in farming communities. This lifestyle, this profession, has been in their family for generations. And now, for some of them, there's nothing left. But even though times are tough on the farm, there's still a lot they're missing out on. I asked some of the young people what the value is of growing up as a farmer's kid. But to my surprise, my mom jumped in instead. I'll tell you another answer to your question that I've seen firsthand, which is that farmers have such big hearts.
Farmers work so hard to raise each crop, but they offer it to you right away without even knowing you. So that comes into the kids' mindset as well. That comes into the upbringing of the family. If you go to any farmer's house, they'll give you lunch, they'll bring you water. Their mindset is very generous. Farmers don't value the money. They value the people. But the sense of community they described, of inviting others into your home, of valuing the people over the profit, it's starting to suffer too. You can even feel the effects of climate change weighing down on the community's culture. When I first started reporting this story, I expected to hear all about how climate change was harming the land and reducing profits, which it is. But I never anticipated the extent to which it could completely unwind the social fabric of a community. My grandfather's community has been farming for generations and generations, developing a deep connection with the land. But now that the land is changing, this ancient culture is changing too. Its customs are changing. Its young people are changing. Their future is changing. And if there's one thing that I came back with, above all, it's that climate change isn't just about economies or plants or profits or farms. It's about people.
Mukta Dharmaparikar. Her reporting is part of the podcast Inherited, produced by YR Media, a national network of young journalists and distributed by Critical Frequency. We've got so much more climate coverage at hereandnow.org, including a conversation about how environmental activists are being killed for their work and how their deaths are sometimes being covered up.
They will often try to distort the narrative around offenders, labeling them anti-terrorism, anti-development, which is why it's so important for us to keep telling their testimony and keep sharing their stories and to really speak truth to power.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Hafsa Qureshi and Eileen Balinski. Gabe Bullard and Jill Ryan edited the show. Technical direction today from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Mike, Max, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.